WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Salesmen who don't have a good product to sell rely on persuasive language and lies. David Mamet's Pulitzer Prize-winning play, Glengarry Glen Ross, is about a group of men selling bad real estate to broke customers. These guys have lots of verbal tricks to get customers to buy. They also use their sales techniques on their boss and on each other to try to get the best customers or the best leads. It's a perfect story for David Mamet, who has a great ear for the music of colloquial speech. Glengarry Glen Ross has been adapted into a film, which opened nationally today. Mamet wrote the screenplay. My guest James Foley directed the film. He assembled a fine cast, including Al Pacino, Jack Lemmon, Ed Harris, and Alan Arkin. In this scene, Ed Harris and Alan Arkin are talking about what they could do if they had good leads.
You're saying a fellow, you're saying, could take those leads and sell them to Graff?
The leads to Graff, yes. I was saying, yeah, a guy could take, like anything else, it seems to me, that is negotiable, a guy could sell them.
How do you know he'd buy them?
Because I worked for him.
You didn't talk to him?
No. What do you mean? Did I talk to him about this?
Yeah. Are you just talking about this, or were you just talking about it?
Yeah, we're just speaking about it.
Speaking about it as an idea.
Yes.
We're not actually talking about it.
No.
Talking about it as a...
No.
As a robbery.
As a robbery? No.
Well.
Hey.
So all this, you didn't actually call Graff, you didn't talk to him?
Not actually, no.
You didn't?
No, not actually.
Did you?
What did I say?
What did you say?
I said not actually. Fuck you care, George. We're just talking.
We are?
Yes.
Because it's a crime.
Robbery. That's right. It is a crime. It's also very safe.
You're actually talking about this.
That's right.
You're going to steal the lead.
Have I said that?
Are you?
Did I say that?
Did you talk to Graff?
What did I say?
What did he say?
What did he say? You buy him.
We recently previewed Glengarry Glen Ross in Philadelphia at a benefit screening for WHYY, and we invited Foley to talk with us in the theater after the film. Foley also directed at Close Range and After Dark, My Sweet. Thanks for coming. It's great to have you here. The language, as we all heard, is not exactly naturalistic. It's a really kind of stylized, like hyper-realist form of colloquial language. When you're reading the script and figuring out what you want to get out of it as the director, how does a Mamet script read different from what you're used to seeing as a script?
Mm-hmm. Well, it's good, which is very it's very different. And I think the most important thing, when I read this screenplay, I certainly was aware of what it was, and I really began to read it with some trepidation, like, why do I want to make a film out of this Pulitzer Prize-winning play? It was not something I ever saw myself doing. And so I read it with, not likely. But what really surprised me was that the reading of it seemed much more emotionally accessible than my memory of the play. I had... thought when I saw the play that it really appealed to me sort of from the neck up and was an interesting intellectual, philosophical, black, humorous sort of experience. But reading the screenplay, for some reasons that I later analyzed for myself, it really opened up a whole nother level of an emotional accessibility to the characters that had not been evident for me on stage.
Did you want people to read the lines naturalistically, or were you looking for something else?
No, that was very important, because I became aware early on that there was a real danger that actors could get into with language like this, where they get seduced by the superficial level of gratification that comes from just saying good dialogue that's written in a rhythmic way. Because if you just memorize the lines and say them fast, they sound good. And so one could get convinced that it actually meant something. And that actually happened a lot when we had actors come in to read, and some really heavyweight actors had come in and read. And they made a big mistake by sort of having prepared in that superficial way. And so it was flashy and entertaining, but totally boring to me. What I was much more interested in was getting actors who had an interior emotional life that was easily accessible. And I felt as if the technical aspects of being able to fire off this rapid dialogue was something that would come later, but it was secondary to me to this internal life, and an internal life specific to cinema actors.
The casting is terrific in the film, but it seems to me you've brought together actors with really different kinds of acting styles. You have Jack Lemmon, who's a kind of like naturalistic actor, and Al Pacino's Al Pacino,
I was going to sit and wait until you get an adjective for each guy.
Yeah. But Ed Harris is kind of chameleon-like in a way, and he can really like blend into a role. But they're, I don't know, like Lemmon's of a different generation than a lot of actors in there, both in terms of his age, but also in terms of his style. And I was wondering if you consciously picked people with different acting styles and what it was like to work with people who, it seems to me, probably take really different approaches to their characters.
There was certainly no intention to deliberately pick people with different styles. It was really, I mean, Al and I literally sat down and made a list of who we thought were the best living actors, without even regards to what parts they could play, how old they were. Who do we think is great? And the list isn't that long, you know, when you sit down and just say who's the best. And we started from that idea and wound up with these guys. And it's very true that they all have very different styles of acting. And it was a great fun for me, particularly when they were all in the scene together. And, you know, you say cut, and then you need to go up and speak to each one of them. And I'd find myself instinctually sort of speaking an entirely different language to each one, which was nice because it made me sort of really expand my own idea of what it means to be a director. And, you know, for me, the most important thing is to do what is needs to be done rather than what you want to do.
So you needed to speak a different language to each of the actors?
Totally, yes.
Okay, and so what would you tell Jack Lemmon as opposed to Al Pacino as opposed
for
to
instance,
Ed Harris?
Jack Lemmon will speak very clearly about the thing quite literally, the thing being what's going on at the moment that, and perhaps the most telling thing is that when Jack would talk about the character, he would say he would say, I think he's feeling this because of this and blah, 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 and say whole articulate sentences. Al would never speak like that because, first of all, he would say I, referring to something, but he would never talk about any kind of singular idea or notion. And something that I understand very much, because if you articulate a single idea that's happening, then you might try, you know, you might sort of glom onto that in too much of a specific way rather than letting all the contradictions and ambivalences that might naturally come out. So he's very reluctant to identify any one particular feeling and even reluctant to finish a sentence. But I began to understand very well what he was talking about, and I agreed with him. So our communication was more like him saying, I think, you know, maybe, you know, and I'd say, yeah, right, more so, blah, blah, blah. And we somehow did it, and even to the point where it got to, you know, where once we had done enough takes where we both felt like we really had it, we would always do one crazy one. And that's, we just call it a crazy one, because to try something just that was a stupid idea. But it's amazing how many of the crazy ones are in there.
When you were rehearsing for this, did you bring in any real salesmen to give a sense of how they do it, to talk about their spiels?
Yeah, we did. Somehow somebody dug up a real guy who came in, who was great. He read the script and was thrilled by it and was very proud that we were making a film about him. And he really was very, he was a good sort of visitor because he thought it was very authentic down to every detail, and that gave everybody encouragement. What was interesting about him was that he had no consciousness whatsoever that there was any irony about the situation. He just thought it was a very good story about these guys and showed how sort of clever they were and stuff like that. And he thought it was quite glamorous. And that was very good because the guys at this point during the rehearsals really needed to connect to that, you know, because they needed to, of course, you know, not see anything ironic about it themselves and, you know, let that take care of it and had to become totally and find some pride in being one of these guys, because, you know, they all are, particularly Ricky Roma being the top of the heap. You know, he was very proud, Al, of his pinky ring. He was always looking at it and sort of happy with his suit that cost $2,000. And he would, like, you know, like he does, get into it.
So what did this guy sell who you brought in, and why did you bring him in?
To be honest, I don't know where what rock people found him under, but but I know he was real, because when I sort of teased him a little bit about perhaps he was, you know, involved in something like, you know, quasi-illegal about maybe what he did in misrepresenting the land, because he had brought himself right up to that point in sort of showing off about how he had really, you know, scammed people and got people to pay much more than the market value of what he was selling. But when I sort of teased him about it, he then got kind of a little bit weird and defensive, because all of a sudden he sort of came back to reality and realized that he was feeling very comfortable, because the guys were all sort of around him and sort of giving him, and these big movie stars were paying attention to this guy. So he was like saying more than he wanted to, and then all of a sudden he realized how far he was going, and he backed up.
So was it useful to have him there?
Yeah, yeah. I think very much. I think if nothing else, to see that a real person existed and that he was, as I say, that he had a sense of real pride in himself.
Now, are you an easy mark for salesmen?
Oh, God, yeah, the worst. I mean, even before this, I could not buy a car. I had to, this is so pathetic, but I had to ask a friend of mine to go with me, and I like stood outside and everything to go in. And it goes, because I have this, not that I'm so such a good guy or moral or anything, but when I'm negotiating with somebody and they want a certain price and I want to pay less, I start thinking, well, this guy has got a family and I'm a movie director. I probably have more money than he does. Why should I do this? And that's not a good position to have. But ever since the movie, it has been one real big effect on me. I cannot look at somebody as a salesman. I mean, even going into a Radio Shack and somebody tries to help me, I just got to leave. So it's made me very, very uncomfortable with that stuff.
Well, are you a more assertive shopper now?
Yeah, I just can't. Anything that has to be negotiated, I don't want any negotiated prices. But this has always been sort of a problem. I mean, it happens in the smallest kind of ways. I just went to a film festival, you know, in Venice and stuff, and you get treated extremely nicely, and they give you, you're flying over first class, and everyone's taking care of you. But then it's sort of like you go in there, and you don't know, like, are your extras being paid for? So can you, like, take a lot of stuff from the mini bar, you know? And I'm like Mr. Frugal and stuff, and I don't want to drink with the mini bar, but I don't have the nerve to ask anybody whether they're going to pay it, so I just don't use the mini bar. It's really sad.
Well, here's a question about money. Al Pacino, very, very highly paid actor, right? I bet this is not like a multi-megabuck kind of movie. There's no special effects. It's not a big glitz film. You know, it's a serious film. I'm not saying it's not funny, but you know what I mean. So were you able to pay him his going rate, or did he take a cut because he particularly liked the movie?
Oh, yeah. No, no one got paid anywhere near their going rate. People got paid very little. But what
it's
was
good you didn't drink from that mini bar then.
Yeah, right. But, you know, I really found that became a very good and positive thing, because there's a weird, perverse thing in Hollywood that the more you're paid, it's like the less motivated you are to actually do the work. Because somehow it's, you know, it becomes so much about the externals of it that the actual content becomes meaningless. But in this case, since nobody was getting money, the focus was very clear. The only reason anybody was doing it was because of what the script was. And it was amazing, and it was a real Pollyanna experience, because nobody ever was late. Nobody ever asked to leave early. Nobody ever asked to change the schedule. People would hang out on the set in between takes, to the extent where, you know, that never happens in movies. You know, all the ADs have to go hunt down the actor, drag him in. And in this case, they had to ask the actors, could you please, you know, go away for a while so we can do our work.
We're listening to a conversation with film director James Foley that we recorded in Philadelphia after a screening of his new movie Glengarry Glen Ross. More after this short break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is James Foley, director of the new film Glengarry Glen Ross. You know, in the movie, all the actors have to sell really crummy real estate. They have really bad leads. The real estate isn't good, and the people who they're supposed to be selling it to don't have the money, and they don't have the interest. I wonder if, like, getting assigned to or volunteering to make a movie that you don't really believe in would be the equivalent of what these guys are up against, selling stuff that isn't good.
That's very interesting. I think exactly that. I have thought about that because I had one experience where I did that, and it was hell. I directed an episode of Twin Peaks, and it was in the second season, and they asked me in the first season, and I couldn't do it. So they asked me at the beginning of the second season, and I said yes, and I made this commitment, and thinking it would be like the first season. By the time I got there, David Lynch had totally abandoned the thing. The scripts, he was not putting input into the writing of the script. He was off in Tokyo selling his art. And there I was stuck with this script that had nothing, that was like faux Lynch, you know? It was like a bunch of people sitting around sort of making believe they were David Lynch, and I'm stuck with this script, and it was horrifying. Nothing was more terrible in my life, because you don't know what to do. I don't know where to put the camera. I don't know what to say to the actors. I just want to go home. And it was really, really an awful experience. Luckily, it was only 4 or 5 days, you know, one episode. But it gave me a lesson about that very thing, that there's no way I could get through making a film that I didn't, even if delusional, didn't think had the potential to be good.
Which episode was it?
I'm going to rent it out. I don't know what the name of it is, the number, but it's an episode where Sherilyn Fenn is being seduced by a guy wearing a cowboy hat. I didn't even know who his character was exactly, but he came in and went out. Oh, and there was a weasel that there was a fashion show going on, and a weasel gets loose and everyone starts screaming and stuff.
Did you watch it back on television, and did it look as bad as it felt when you were doing it?
No, because you know, you have a couple of beers and you turn the sound down on loud and you think, well, it's okay. And then music comes in, bum-bong, bum-bong, and it kind of looks like Twin Peaks. But in retrospect, I do think definitely that there's conventional wisdom that it just fell apart in the second year.
When you're directing a movie in which all the actors in it are playing the part of somebody who's very aggressive and in selling, are they that way when you're trying to direct them? Was it intimidating at all because they're all playing these really manipulative people who have their raps and they have their ways?
No, it was, which has been my experience really on every film, that actors really, really want to be directed and they want interaction.
Even the big stars?
Oh, well, that's what's great. Is that, you know, doesn't matter who it is, you know, they just, and I really think the best actors, I mean, you know, like Al and the rest of the guys, are so interested in trying anything that they very much want a reaction. And what was interesting, as you said before, is that each person wants that reaction in a different way. I mean, some people don't want you to say certain things, and other people do want you to say certain things. And that's the fun part, is this instinctual idea of figuring out what it is that they need at what time, including sometimes being a little bit pushing a little bit more than they might want at the time. But there's a mutual understanding of what you're doing.
Who did you push?
Oh, I pushed them all at different times in different ways, you know. But it's just, it's all different how you push them. Because sometimes pushing just means, let's do another take right now, really fast. And they go, well, wait. And you say, no, it has to be really fast because, you know, we're really in, and you sort of discombobulate them on purpose because you feel like perhaps we're getting into a kind of a rut and it's getting too precious and people are getting too conscious of what they're saying and you want to. And I've taken to do weird things like, you know, I demand silence all the time from everybody on the crew and everything. And I'm always barking about that. And then I get total silence. And then when it's ready to go, I scream, cut, not cut. What do I scream? Action. One of those two things. Just scream, action, like as loud as I can, which is like really startling. And then the actor's got to start saying his line. But it's sort of like sometimes you see them standing there and they're getting too much into a plan of what they're going to do. And you want them to forget their plan and let whatever happens going to happen. And so it's all different things of doing. I actually threw a fit once, a fake fit, yelling at somebody on the crew just to you know, get the actors out of their lethargy and change the mood, the electricity on the set.
Was the crew member in on the fact that this is a fake fit?
Yes, I made sure I did that.
So what were you throwing the fit about?
I was throwing the fit about people talking, because I'm famous for throwing fits, real fits, because people will not shut up. So I asked this one guy to talk, Right, so then I could turn around and scream at him. It worked.
Did it get what you wanted?
Oh, yeah, definitely.
So what did it get you doing this?
It got me the actors being more immediate, that the thing you always have to fight, you know, on take 11 is that people are doing the exact same thing, and it begins to become... they begin to remember that they just did it before, and so there's a repetition, an inevitable repetition. So it's almost like this feeling you have, you know, when all of a sudden in the middle of the day, the weather changes dramatically, and it goes from being sunny and calm, and then wind is coming, and you feel your whole mood and everything change, and you've got to sort of change the weather on the set sometimes.
You're friends with Sean Penn, and you've directed him in a movie. Is it harder to direct a friend than an actor who you admire and you don't know at all, or vice versa, or mm-hmm. no correlation?
I don't think I would ever start to do a movie with the lead actors. I didn't have some kind of personal relationship with them and know them well enough. I mean, my litmus test is I have to be able to make fun of them and make fun of who they are and of their fame. It's very important to sort of feel as if that's a joke, and no, we don't care about that. And in Sean's case, I knew him a lot. You know, we were very good friends, and it creates a very positive opportunity because you know somebody very well, and it becomes very sort of private, and you can be very specifically emotional. And there's just that thing that friends have where you don't have to have any kind of formality about it. The flip side, however, is something that always interests me, but I've gotten a lot better about, is that you have your own emotional life that's going on during the movie, and sometimes you get in a position where you have to, it's not equal, because the actor is doing what they're doing and they're using their emotions. And in a certain way, you are in a very, you know, in emotional movies, you're creating an environment where they can express their emotions, and that's the most important thing. And their emotions are more important than your emotions during that time, because, you know, you got to get on with it and you do that. And sometimes, you know, you get your feelings hurt, but you can't, you know, stop the movie because somebody hurt your feelings, but it happens to be like a very good friend of yours. And so in different times, you know, that can be something where my own persecution complex can like well up, and I feel like, why is God punishing me by making me do this? But there's less of that the more movies I do.
Listen, it's been wonderful to have you here, and it's been wonderful to get the kind of insights that you could give us into this film and into filmmaking in general. So thank you very, very much for being here.
Okay, thank you. Thank you.
James Foley directed the new film Glengarry Glen Ross. We spoke at a movie theater in Philadelphia after a screening of the film. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.